People liked her face. The face was too cold, the eyes too intense. Nothing could ever lend her the charm of a soft focus. The beautiful legs, slanting down from the chair's arm in the center of his vision, annoyed him. They spoiled the rest of his estimate. She remained silent. He was forced to ask, "Did you decide to order it just like that, on the spur of the moment, over a telephone?"
"I decided it 6 months ago. I was waiting for Hank Reardon to get ready to go into production."
"Don't call him Hank Reardon. It's vulgar."
"That's what everybody calls him. Don't change the subject."
"Why did you have to telephone him last night?"
"Couldn't reach him sooner."
"Why didn't you wait until you got back to New York and—"
"Because I'd seen the Rio Norte line."
"Well, I need time to consider it, to place the matter before the board, to consult the best—"
"There is no time."
"You haven't given me a chance to form an opinion."
"I don't give a damn about your opinion. I'm not going to argue with you, with your board, or with your professors. You have a choice to make, and you're going to make it now. Just say yes or no."
"That's a preposterous, high-handed, arbitrary way of—"
"Yes or no."
"That's the trouble with you. You always make it yes or no. Things are never absolute like that. Nothing is absolute."
"Metal rails are. Whether we get them or not is." She waited. He did not answer.
"Well," she asked, "are you taking the responsibility for it?"
"I am."
"Go ahead," he said, and added, "but at your own risk. I won't cancel it, but I won't commit myself as to what I'll say to the board."
"Say anything you wish." She rose to go.
He leaned forward across the desk, reluctant to end the interview, and to end it so decisively. "You realize, of course, that a lengthy procedure will be necessary to put this through," he said. The words sounded almost hopeful. "It isn't as simple as that."
"Oh, sure," she said. "I'll send you a detailed report which Eddie will prepare and which you won't read. Eddie will help you put it through the works. I'm going to Philadelphia tonight to see Reardon. He and I have a lot of work to do." She added, "It's as simple as that, Jim."
She had turned to go when he spoke again, and what he said seemed bewilderingly irrelevant. "That's all right for you, because you're lucky. Others can't do it."
"Do what?"
"Other people are human. They're sensitive. They can't devote their whole life to metals and engines. You're lucky. You've never had any feelings. You've never felt anything at all."
As she looked at him, her dark gray eyes went slowly from astonishment to stillness, then to a strange expression that resembled a look of weariness, except that it seemed to reflect much more than the endurance of this one moment.
"No, Jim," she said quietly. "I guess I've never felt anything at all."
Eddie Willers followed her to her office. Whenever she returned, he felt as if the world became clear, simple, easy to face, and he forgot his moments of shapeless apprehension. He was the only person who found it completely natural that she should be the operating vice president of a great railroad, even though she was a woman. She had told him when he was 10 years old that she would run the railroad someday. It did not astonish him now, just as it had not astonished him that day in a clearing of the woods. When they entered her office, when he saw her sit down at the desk and glance at the memos he had left for her, he felt as he did in his car when the motor caught on and the wheels could move forward. He was about to leave her office when he remembered a matter he had not reported. "Owen Kellogg of the Terminal Division has asked me for an appointment to see you," he said. She looked up, astonished.
"That's funny. I was going to send for him.
Have him come up. I want to see him."
"Eddie," she added suddenly, "before I start, tell them to get me Ayers of the Ayers Music Publishing Company on the phone."
"The Music Publishing Company?" he repeated incredulously.
"Yes, there's something I want to ask him."
When the voice of Mr. Ayers, courteously eager, inquired of what service he could be to her, she asked,
"Can you tell me whether Richard Halley has written a new piano concerto, the fifth?"
"A fifth concerto, Miss Taggart? Why, no, of course he hasn't."
"Are you sure?"
"Quite sure, Miss Taggart. He has not written anything for 8 years."
"Is he still alive?"
"Why, yes. That is, I can't say for certain. He has dropped out of public life entirely, but I'm sure we would have heard of it if he had died."
"If he wrote anything, would you know about it?"
"Of course, we would be the first to know. We publish all of his work. But he has stopped writing."
"I see. Thank you."
when Owen Kellogg entered her office. She looked at him with satisfaction. She was glad to see that she had been right in her vague recollection of his appearance. His face had the same quality as that of the young brakeman on the train, the face of the kind of man with whom she could deal. "Sit down, Mr. Kellogg," she said. But he remained standing in front of her desk. "You had asked me once to let you know if I ever decided to change my employment, Miss Taggart," he said. "So I came to tell you that I'm quitting." She had expected anything but that. It took her a moment before she asked quietly, "Why?" "For a personal reason." "Were you dissatisfied here?" "No." "Have you received a better offer?" "No." "What railroad are you going to?" "I'm not going to any railroad, Miss Taggart." "Then what job are you taking?" "I have not decided that yet." She studied him, feeling slightly uneasy. There was no hostility in his face. He looked straight at her. He answered simply, directly. He spoke like one who has nothing to hide or to show. The face was polite and empty. "Then why should you wish to quit?" "It's a personal matter." "Are you ill?" "Is it a question of your health?" "No." "Are you leaving the city?" "No." "Have you inherited money that permits you to retire?" "No." "Do you intend to continue working for a living?" "Yes." "But you do not wish to work for Taggart Transcontinental?" "No." "In that case, something must have happened here to cause your decision." "What?" "Nothing, Miss Taggart." "I wish you'd tell me. I have a reason for wanting to know." "Would you take my word for it, Miss Taggart?" "Yes." "No person, matter, or event connected with my job here had any bearing upon my decision." "You have no specific complaint against Taggart Transcontinental?" "None." "Then I think you might reconsider when you hear what I have to offer you." "I'm sorry, Miss Taggart, I can't." "May I tell you what I have in mind?" "Yes, if you wish." "Would you take my word for it that I decided to offer you the post I'm going to offer before you asked to see me?" "I want you to know that." "I will always take your word, Miss Taggart." "It's the post of superintendent of the Ohio Division." "It's yours if you want it." His face showed no reaction, as if the words had no more significance for him than for a savage who had never heard of railroads. "I don't want it, Miss Taggart," he answered. After a moment, she said, her voice tight, "Write your own ticket, Kellogg. Name your price. I want you to stay. I can match anything any other railroad offers you." "I'm not going to work for any other railroad." "I thought you loved your work." This was the first sign of emotion in him. Just a slight widening of his eyes and an oddly quiet emphasis in his voice when he answered, "I do." "Then tell me what it is that I should say in order to hold you." It had been involuntary and so obviously frank that he looked at her as if it had reached him. "Perhaps I'm being unfair by coming here to tell you that I'm quitting, Miss Taggart. I know that you asked me to tell you because you wanted to have a chance to make me a counteroffer. So if I came, it looks as if I'm open to a deal, but I'm not. I came only because I wanted to keep my word to you." That one break in his voice was like a sudden flash that told her how much her interest in her request had meant to him, and that his decision had not been an easy one to make. "Kellogg, is there nothing I can offer you?" she asked. "Nothing, Miss Taggart. Nothing on earth." He turned to go. For the first time in her life, she felt helpless and beaten. "Why?" she asked, not addressing him. He stopped. He shrugged and smiled. He was alive for a moment, and it was the strangest smile she had ever seen. It held secret amusement and heartbreak and an infinite bitterness. He answered, "Who is John Galt?" Chapter 2. The Chain. It began with a few lights. As a train of the Taggart line rolled toward Philadelphia, a few brilliant, scattered lights appeared in the darkness. They seemed purposeless in the empty plane, yet too powerful to have no purpose. The passengers watched them idly without interest. The black shape of a structure came next, barely visible against the sky, then a big building close to the tracks. The building was dark, and the reflections of the train lights streaked across the solid glass of its walls. An oncoming freight train hid the view, filling the windows with a rushing smear of noise. In a sudden break above the flat cars, the passengers saw distant structures under a faint reddish glow in the sky. The glow moved in irregular spasms, as if the structures were breathing. When the freight train vanished, they saw angular buildings wrapped in coils of steam. The rays of a few strong lights cut straight sheaths through the coils. The steam was red as the sky. The thing that came next did not look like a building, but like a shell of checkered glass enclosing girders, cranes, and trusses in a solid, blinding orange spread of flame. The passengers could not grasp the complexity of what seemed to be a city stretched for miles, active, without sign of human presence. They saw towers that looked like contorted skyscrapers, bridges hanging in midair, and sudden wounds spurting fire from out of solid walls. They saw a line of glowing cylinders moving through the night. The cylinders were red-hot metal. An office building appeared close to the tracks. The big neon sign on its roof lighted the interiors of the coaches as they went by. It said Reardon Steel. A passenger, who was a professor of economics, remarked to his companion, "Of what importance is an individual in the titanic collective achievements of our industrial age?" Another, who was a journalist, made a note for future use in his column, "Hank Reardon is the kind of man who sticks his name on everything he touches. You may from this form your own opinion about the character of Hank Reardon." The train was speeding on into the darkness when a red gasp shot to the sky from behind a long structure. The passengers paid no attention. One more heat of steel being poured was not an event they had been taught to notice. It was the first heat for the First Order of Reardon metal. To the men at the tap hole of the furnace inside the mills, the first break of the liquid metal into the open came as a shocking sensation of mourning. The narrow streak pouring through space had the pure white color of sunlight. Black coils of steam were boiling upward, streaked with violent red. Fountains of sparks shot in beating spasms as from broken arteries. The air seemed torn to rags, reflecting a raging flame that was not there, red blotches whirling and running through space, as if not to be contained within a man-made structure, as if about to consume the columns, the girders, the bridges of cranes overhead. But the liquid metal had no aspect of violence. It was a long white curve, with the texture of satin and the friendly radiance of a smile. It flowed obediently through a spout of clay, with two brittle borders to restrain it. It fell through 20 feet of space down into a ladle that held 200 tons. A flow of stars hung above the stream, leaping out of its placid smoothness, looking delicate as lace and innocent as children's sparklers. Only at a closer glance could one notice that the white satin was boiling. Splashes flew out at times and fell to the ground below. They were metal, and cooling while hitting the soil, they burst into flame. 200 tons of metal, which was to be harder than steel, running liquid at a temperature of 4,000 degrees, had the power to annihilate every wall of the structure and every one of the men who worked by the stream. But every inch of its course, every pound of its pressure, and the content of every molecule within it were controlled and made by a conscious intention that had worked upon it for 10 years. Swinging through the darkness of the shed, the red glare kept slashing the face of a man who stood in a distant corner. He stood leaning against a column, watching. The glare cut a moment's wedge across his eyes, which had the color and quality of pale blue ice, then across the black web of the metal column and the ash-blonde strands of his hair, then across the belt of his trench coat and the pockets where he held his hands. His body was tall and gaunt. He had always been too tall for those around him. His face was cut by prominent cheekbones and by a few sharp lines. They were not the lines of age. He had always had them. This had made him look old at 20, and young now at 45. Ever since he could remember, he had been told that his face was ugly, because it was unyielding, and cruel, because it was expressionless. It remained expressionless now, as he looked at the metal. He was Hank Reardon. The metal came rising to the top of the ladle and went running over with arrogant prodigality. Then the blinding white trickles turned to glowing brown, and in one more instant, they were black icicles of metal starting to crumble off. The slag was crusting in thick brown ridges that looked like the crust of the earth. As the crust grew thicker, a few craters broke open, with the white liquid still boiling within. A man came riding through the air in the cab of a crane overhead. He pulled a lever by the casual movement of one hand. Steel hooks came down on a chain, seized the handles of the ladle, lifted it smoothly like a bucket of milk, and 200 tons of metal went sailing through space toward a row of molds waiting to be filled. Hank Reardon leaned back, closing his eyes. He felt the column trembling with the rumble of the crane. The job was done, he thought. A worker saw him and grinned in understanding, like a fellow accomplice in a great celebration who knew why that tall, blonde figure had had to be present here tonight. Reardon smiled in answer. It was the only salute he had received. Then he started back for his office, once again a figure with an expressionless face. It was late when Hank Reardon left his office that night to walk from his mills to his house. It was a walk of some miles through empty country, but he had felt like doing it, without conscious reason. He walked, keeping one hand in his pocket. His fingers closed about a bracelet. It was made of Reardon metal, in the shape of a chain. His fingers moved, feeling its texture once in a while. It had taken 10 years to make that bracelet. 10 years, he thought, is a long time. The road was dark, edged with trees. Looking up, he could see a few leaves against the stars. The leaves were twisted and dry, ready to fall. There were distant lights in the windows of houses scattered through the countryside, but the lights made the road seem lonelier. He never felt loneliness except when he was happy. He turned once in a while to look back at the red glow of the sky over the mills. He did not think of the 10 years. What remained of them tonight was only a feeling which he could not name, except that it was quiet and solemn. The feeling was a sum, and he did not have to count again the parts that had gone to make it. But the parts unrecalled were there, within the feeling. They were the night spent at scorching ovens in the research laboratory of the mills, the night spent in the workshop of his home over sheets of paper which he filled with formulas, then tore up in angry failure, the days when the young scientists of the small staff he had chosen to assist him waited for instructions like soldiers ready for a hopeless battle, having exhausted their ingenuity, still willing but silent, with the unspoken sentence hanging in the air, "Mr. Reardon, it can't be done." The meals, interrupted and abandoned at the sudden flash of a new thought, a thought to be pursued at once, to be tried, to be tested, to be worked on for months, and to be discarded as another failure. The moment snatched from conferences, from contracts, from the duties of running the best steel mills in the country, snatched almost guiltily as for a secret love. The one thought held immovably across a span of 10 years, under everything he did and everything he saw. The thought held in his mind when he looked at the buildings of a city, at the track of a railroad, at the light in the windows of a distant farmhouse, at the knife in the hands of a beautiful woman cutting a piece of fruit at a banquet. The thought of a metal alloy that would do more than steel had ever done, a metal that would be to steel what steel had been to iron. The acts of self-racking when he discarded a hope or a sample, not permitting himself to know that he was tired, not giving himself time to feel, driving himself through the ringing torture of not good enough, still not good enough, and going on with no motor save the conviction that it could be done. Then the day when it was done, and its result was called Reardon metal. These were the things that had come to white heat, had melted and fused within him, and their alloy was a strange, quiet feeling that made him smile at the countryside in the darkness and wonder why happiness could hurt. After a while he realized that he was thinking of his past, as if certain days of it were spread before him, demanding to be seen again. He did not want to look at them. He despised memories as a pointless indulgence. But then he understood that he thought of them tonight in honor of that piece of metal in his pocket. Then he permitted himself to look. He saw the day when he stood on a rocky ledge and felt a thread of sweat running from his temple down his neck. He was 14 years old, and it was his first day of work in the iron mines of Minnesota. He was trying to learn to breathe against the scalding pain in his chest. He stood cursing himself, because he had made up his mind that he would not be tired. After a while he went back to his task. He decided that pain was not a valid reason for stopping. He saw the day when he stood at the window of his office and looked at the mines. He owned them as of that morning. He was 30 years old. What had gone on in the years between did not matter, just as pain had not mattered. He had worked in mines and foundries, in the steel mills of the North, moving toward the purpose he had chosen. All he remembered of those jobs was that the men around him had never seemed to know what to do, while he had always known. He remembered wondering why so many iron mines were closing, just as these had been about to close until he took them over. He looked at the shelves of rock in the distance. Workers were putting up a new sign above a gate at the end of a road. Reardon Ore. He saw an evening when he sat slumped across his desk in that office. It was late and his staff had left, so he could lie there alone unwitnessed. He was tired. It was as if he had run a race against his own body, and all the exhaustion of years which he had refused to acknowledge had caught him at once and flattened him against the desktop. He felt nothing except the desire not to move. He did not have the strength to feel, not even to suffer. He had burned everything there was to burn within him. He had scattered so many sparks to start so many things, and he wondered whether someone could give him now the spark he needed, now when he felt unable ever to rise again. He asked himself who had started him and kept him going. Then he raised his head. Slowly, with the greatest effort of his life, he made his body rise until he was able to sit upright with only one hand pressed to the desk and a trembling arm to support him. He never asked that question again. He saw the day when he stood on a hill and looked at a grimy wasteland of structures that had been a steel plant. It was closed and given up. He had bought it the night before. There was a strong wind, and a gray light squeezed from among the clouds. In that light he saw the brown red of rust, like dead blood on the steel of the giant cranes, and bright green living weeds, like gorged cannibals growing over piles of broken glass at the foot of walls made of empty frames. At a gate in the distance he saw the black silhouettes of men. They were the unemployed from the rotting hovels of what had once been a prosperous town. They stood silently, looking at the glittering car he had left at the gate of the mills. They wondered whether the man on the hill was the Hank Reardon that people were talking about, and whether it was true that the mills were to be reopened. "The historical cycle of steelmaking in Pennsylvania is obviously running down," a newspaper had said, "and experts agree that Henry Reardon's venture into steel is hopeless. You may soon witness the sensational end of the sensational Henry Reardon." That was 10 years ago. Tonight the cold wind on his face felt like the wind of that day. He turned to look back. The red glow of the mills breathed in the sky, a sight as life-giving as a sunrise. These had been his stops, the stations which an express had reached and passed. He remembered nothing distinct of the years between them. The years were blurred, like a streak of speed. Whatever it was, he thought, whatever the strain and the agony, they were worth it, because they had made him reach this day. This day when the first heat of the first order of Reardon metal had been poured to become rails for Taggart Transcontinental. He touched the bracelet in his pocket. He had had it made from that first poured metal. It was for his wife. As he touched it, he realized suddenly that he had thought of an abstraction called his wife, not of the woman to whom he was married. He felt a stab of regret, wishing he had not made the bracelet. Then a wave of self-reproach for the regret. He shook his head. This was not the time for his old doubts. He felt that he could forgive anything to anyone, because happiness was the greatest agent of purification. He felt certain that every living being wished him well tonight. He wanted to meet someone, to face the first stranger, to stand, disarmed and open, and to say, "Look at me." People, he thought, were as hungry for a sight of joy as he had always been, for a moment's relief from that gray load of suffering, which seemed so inexplicable and unnecessary. He had never been able to understand why men should be unhappy. The dark road had risen imperceptibly to the top of a hill. He stopped and turned. The red glow was a narrow strip far to the west. Above it, small, at a distance of miles, the words of a neon sign stood written on the blackness of the sky. Reardon Steel. He stood straight, as if before a bench of judgment. He thought that in the darkness of this night other signs were lighted over the country. Reardon ore, Reardon coal, Reardon limestone. He thought of the days behind him. He wished it were possible to light a neon sign above them, saying, Reardon life. He turned sharply and walked on. As the road came closer to his house, he noticed that his steps were slowing down and that something was ebbing away from his mood. He felt a dim reluctance to enter his home, which he did not want to feel. No, he thought, not tonight. They'll understand it tonight. But he did not know, he had never defined, what it was that he wanted them to understand. He saw lights in the windows of the living room when he approached his house. The house stood on a hill, rising before him like a big white bulk. It looked naked, with a few semi-colonial pillars for reluctant ornament. It had the cheerless look of a nudity not worth revealing. He was not certain whether his wife noticed him when he entered the living room. She sat by the fireplace, talking, the curve of her arm floating in graceful emphasis of her words. He heard a small break in her voice and thought that she had seen him, but she did not look up, and her sentence went on smoothly. He could not be certain. "But it's just that a man of culture is bored with the alleged wonders of purely material ingenuity," she was saying. "He simply refuses to get excited about plumbing." Then she turned her head, looked at Reardon in the shadows across the long room, and her arms spread gracefully, like two swan necks by her sides. "Why, darling," she said in a bright tone of amusement, "isn't it too early to come home? Wasn't there some slag to sweep or tuyere to polish?" They all turned to him, his mother, his brother Philip, and Paul Larkin, their old friend. "I'm sorry," he answered. "I know I'm late."
"Don't say you're sorry," said his mother. "You could have telephoned."
He looked at her, trying vaguely to remember something.
"You promised to be here for dinner tonight."
"Oh, that's right, I did. I'm sorry. But today at the mills, we poured..." He stopped. He did not know what made him unable to utter the one thing he had come home to say. He added only, "It's just that I forgot."
"That's what Mother means," said Philip.
"Oh, let him get his bearings. He's not quite here yet. He's still at the mills," his wife said gaily. "Do take your coat off, Henry." Paul Larkin was looking at him with the devoted eyes of an inhibited dog. "Hello, Paul," said Reardon. "When did you get in?"
"Oh, I just hopped down on the 5:35 from New York."
Larkin was smiling in gratitude for the attention.
"Trouble?
Who hasn't got trouble these days?"
Larkin's smile became resigned, to indicate that the remark was merely philosophical.
"But no special trouble this time. I just thought I'd drop in to see you."
His wife laughed.
"You've disappointed him, Paul."
She turned to Reardon.
"Is it an inferiority complex or a superiority one, Henry? Do you believe that nobody can want to see you just for your own sake? Or do you believe that nobody can get along without your help?"
He wanted to utter an angry denial, but she was smiling at him as if this were merely a conversational joke, and he had no capacity for the sort of conversations which were not supposed to be meant, so he did not answer. He stood looking at her, wondering about the things he had never been able to understand. Lillian Reardon was generally regarded as a beautiful woman. She had a tall, graceful body, the kind that looked well in high-waisted gowns of the Empire style, which she made it a practice to wear. Her exquisite profile belonged to a cameo of the same period. Its pure, proud lines and the lustrous, light brown waves of her hair, worn with classical simplicity, suggested an austere, imperial beauty. But when she turned full face, people experienced a small shock of disappointment. Her face was not beautiful. The eyes were the flaw. They were vaguely pale, neither quite gray nor brown, lifelessly empty of expression. Reardon had always wondered, since she seemed amused so often, why there was no gaiety in her face.
"We have met before, dear," she said in answer to his silent scrutiny, "though you don't seem to be sure of it."
"Have you had any dinner, Henry?" his mother asked. There was a reproachful impatience in her voice, as if his hunger were a personal insult to her.
"Yes. No, I wasn't hungry."
"I'd better ring to have them."
"No, Mother, not now. It doesn't matter."
That's the trouble I've always had with you. She was not looking at him, but reciting words into space. It's no use trying to do things for you. You don't appreciate it. I could never make you eat properly.
Henry, you work too hard, said Philip. It's not good for you.
Reardon laughed.
I like it.